Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question and answer session of today's call. At that time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star one. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the meeting over to Dr. Jack Stein. Thank you, and you may begin.
Thank you, and good morning, everybody. This is Jack Stein. I'm the director for the Office of Science Policy and Communications at the National Institute on Drug Abuse, which is part of the National Institutes of Health. And we'd like to welcome you all to a teleconference press briefing on Monitoring the Future study. This is the 42nd year of this study, which is supported by NIDA and conducted by the University of Michigan. We're delighted to host this today, and let me quickly explain how we'll proceed and then move right into our briefing. Following my brief comments, we'll have a presentation by several of the principals involved or connected with this study. We'll first begin with the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and that is Dr. Nora Volkoff. Following Dr. Volkoff's comments, we will have Mr. Michael Botticelli, the director of the National Drug Control Policy. Following his comments will be Drs. Lloyd Johnston and Richard Miek, both from the University of Michigan, who are individuals responsible for conducting the Monitoring the Future study. I do want to mention that supporting documents for this teleconference, including press releases, visuals, and overview of findings, can be found on the NIDA website at drugabuse.gov. And now I'd like to turn things over to the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, Dr. Nora Volkoff, who will have some brief comments about the study. Dr. Volkoff.
Yeah, Dr. Stein, thanks. And first of all, I'm delighted to actually have this press release today, and I want to welcome the interest from the reporters. It's actually a year where we're seeing incredibly good news as it relates to the patterns of drug use among teenagers, and this is observed across all of the age grades that are surveyed by Monitoring the Future, 8, 10, and 12, and basically across most of the drugs of abuse for all of the years except more stable levels for 12 graders and marijuana. Specifically, we have seen the lowest levels of use of heroin, methamphetamine, cocaine, ecstasy, and inhalants that have even been recorded since the inception of Monitoring the Future. And this is across all ages. Also, we have seen the lowest rates of drug use for the legal drugs, and that includes the lowest levels ever of nicotine and the lowest levels ever of alcohol. In parallel, we've seen significant decreases in the abuse of prescription opioids, which was a big surprise because we actually are living one of the worst epidemics in our country on the prescription diversion and abuse among the general population, and thus we were concerned that this will influence teenagers. But we have seen a 45% decrease in the past 5 years on the abuse of prescription opioids. We were also very surprised and concerned initially had been by the fact, and again, also, we are living an increase in the use of heroin across the adult population in the United States with its devastating consequences. So we were concerned that these will also translate into patterns in teenagers. And yet we saw the lowest rates of heroin use that we have recorded. So both the prescription opioid epidemic as well as the heroin patterns in the adults are not translating into the teenagers. The other major surprise, of course, was marijuana, because we have been concerned all along with the changes in the legalization of marijuana, either for medical or recreational purposes, that is also translated among the adult population in an increase in consumption of marijuana, that this could also affect teenagers. And yet we're observing, actually, that there are significant decreases in marijuana consumption in 8th and 10th grade. The levels of marijuana use among 12th grades, on the other hand, are stable. So despite all of the decreases in all of the other drugs, marijuana use is stable among 12th graders. And this really portends the area of risk that we're now identifying as it relates to marijuana, where we are seeing the highest increases in those that are 18 to 24. And similarly, highlighting the importance of actually to understand how these policy issues influence patterns of marijuana use in our country. We do know from the survey that marijuana use is more frequent among states that have legalized medical marijuana than those that have not. So these are really remarkable news, and the challenge to us is, of course, try to understand what is driving these very significant, wonderful decreases in drug consumption patterns among teenagers in our country, so that we can ensure that we can strengthen them, for once, but we also can sustain them. At this point, I mean, some of it relates, of course, to prevention measures, but others may relate to issues that at this point we haven't properly investigated or clearly identified. So what are the areas of concern? Areas of concerns is that the use of marijuana, particularly regular marijuana use, which is particularly problematic for the effects in the brain and other organs, are still very high among 12th graders. 6% of the 12th graders are using marijuana. The concept that the notion that marijuana is harmless is becoming more frequent, and we know that in turn that influences adolescents. If they think it's not harmful, they are more likely to take marijuana. So those are issues that we need to address. And with that, again, I want to thank Dr. Lloyd Johnson, who is going to be retiring. This is going to be his last survey as a principal investigator, and he has been a wonderful, wonderful colleague that has allowed this study not just to exist, but actually to flourish and to guide you in policies on how to properly prevent drug use among teenagers. And with that, I introduce Dr. Lloyd Johnson.
Actually, we're going to have shortly. Thank you, Dr. Volkov. We're going to next hear from actually Mr. Michael Botticelli, the Director of National Drug Control Policy, and following that, we'll turn things over to our investigators from University of Michigan. So, Director Botticelli.
Great. Thanks, Dr. Stein, and thank you, Dr. Volkov, for this incredible work. Thank you, everybody, for being on the call. As Dr. Volkov said, the 2016 Monitoring the Future survey indeed includes some very, very good news. Teen tobacco and alcohol use are at record lows. As Dr. Volkov said, are particularly important to us in light of the opioid epidemic is the dramatic decrease in prescription opioid pain reliever use among 12th graders, down 45% over the past 5 years, as well as the long-term decline in the use of many other substances, including marijuana, among younger age groups is continuing. And this is all really good news, and it's very encouraging to see more young people making healthy choices and choosing not to use substances. We need, as Dr. Volkov said, to keep doing all we can to support young people through evidence-based prevention efforts and treatment for those who may develop substance use disorders. And, you know, we have often said that we all have a role to play in preventing drug use, everybody at the community level, from police officers, healthcare providers, local leaders, public health officials, parents, teachers, faith leaders. We all have a role to play in setting community norms as it relates to substance use issues. Prevention is a strategically important priority for our administration. It's the key, one of the key parts of the National Drug Control Strategy. And many of you might have seen the Surgeon General's historic report on addiction released last month, talking about the importance of evidence-based prevention efforts. You know, when we were in Atlanta this past March, President Obama talked about the need for prevention. And he said, "We have a healthcare system that too often is really a disease care system. We wait until people get sick and then we treat them. And we don't spend enough time thinking about how to keep people well and healthy and balanced and centered in the first place." And this afternoon, the president is giving us a big boost. He will sign the 21st Century Cures Act, which authorizes $1 billion in new funding to address the opioid epidemic. As you know, he made a bold call to Congress almost a year ago for this funding. And the president and his team fought to make it happen, and people affected by this epidemic made their voices heard. And last week, Congress finally acted, and the bill the president will sign today includes $1 billion in new funding for treatment and prevention. And this funding couldn't come at a moment too soon. Last week, the CDC released its new mortality statistics. Tragically, in 2015, 91 people per day died from drug overdoses involving opioids, up from 78 in 2014. We are pleased to see that new initiates to prescription drugs are down and that prescription drug use misuse is down among our youngest folks, but too many people are still suffering and overdosing from opioid use disorders. We need to get this money out so we can expand access to prevention, treatment, and recovery services all across this country, and this funding will help us get us there. And now I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Lloyd Johnson from the University of Michigan. But before I do, I really want to thank him for leading this survey from its beginning in from 1975 through today. The Monitoring the Future survey is one of our prime tools to look at drug use, and these data reported by Dr. Johnson and his team, as well as our colleagues at NIDA, help us make sure that our policies are working to affect and reduce drug use and its consequences in the United States. And I know this survey will be in good hands of Dr. Meek's capable hands going forward. So thank you, Dr. Johnson, and congratulations on your well-earned retirement. I'll turn it over to you.
I love your name, sir.
Okay, well,
this is Cornbread here.
If I can ask folks to mute their phones who are on the line.
Whatever. Nice phrase.
Eat their phones. Almost.
So when DCP can mute their phones, we'd like to continue.
Our line is muted. Our line.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. Saima, I don't know if there's anything you can do.
I wish we had name tags.
Everything. Very good. Thank you. We'd like to move on now to Dr. Johnston and a beautiful introduction from Director Botticelli. So please proceed.
Well, let me start by thanking very much Dr. Volkoff and Mr. Botticelli for kind remarks about the study. This is the 42nd year that we have done national surveys of young people. We didn't start with the younger 8th and 10th graders until 1991, but still a long time. Like most years, we surveyed about 45,000 secondary school students located in some 372 public and private high schools that are nationally representative of the coterminous United States. We've been doing this for a long time, but this is the first year that I can remember where nearly all substances are in decline, both licit and illicit. So we're talking about tobacco and alcohol and many of the illicit drugs, including some of the most widely used ones, like amphetamines, which are down about half since we measured them in a peak level in 2004. Amphetamines were being used for a while by high school seniors, I think, to help studies, much like the college students. But that seems to be passing, and the rates are going down. Narcotic drugs, as you've heard, are extremely important because of the number of people that we're losing to overdoses with narcotics. It doesn't tend to be concentrated among secondary school students, but they in turn will make up much of the those in their 20s in the future. And so it's very good to see that we've seen nearly a one-half drop in the proportion of high school seniors who say that they have used prescription narcotics without medical supervision. And by the way, while I'm on that subject, one of the things we ask them is where do they get the drugs that they're using? And with narcotics, some 40% of the high school seniors say they get them from prescriptions that they already had. In other words, there's a lot of leftover medication that they go back to and use for non-medical purposes. And I think that one implication of that is that perhaps physicians and dentists should be reducing the number of doses they put in a prescription. A person can always come back and ask for more. But having that much leftover narcotic drugs in their own prescription seems to be a problem. Ecstasy and more generally MDMA, which includes both ecstasy and Molly, are down by about two-thirds in the last few years. So that's been a big change as well. Sedatives are down by about half in terms of use outside of medical supervision. Heroin, as you've heard, is down a great deal by roughly 80% from the peak levels in the late 90s. So these are some of the most important and prevalent of the drugs, and they're down. The question, of course, is why are they down, and what can we do about continuing whatever is causing them to go down? And I think there's maybe two factors involved. One is that many fewer young people today are using either cigarettes or alcohol, which tend to be the first drugs that young people get into before they proceed on to marijuana and the various illicit drugs. And these are now, as you've heard, at the lowest levels that we've ever recorded. Cigarette smoking, if we look at eighth graders and how many of them have tried a cigarette, if we look back in 96, it was 50% of the eighth graders. Today it's only 10%. So many fewer have even initiated cigarettes, let alone currently use them. And with alcohol, ever use was at 56% back in 94, the mid-90s. Today it's down to 23%, about a 60% drop. And that's in terms of eighth graders who've ever had one drink. So what we've seen is a real decline in the two illicit drugs. And I think it's quite possible that that's contributing to the number of people who then move on to the illicits. And as you heard from Dr. Volkoff, there is a connection there. The other thing to mention, and it has to do with Mr. Botticelli's urging of community action, is we've seen a considerable drop in availability for particularly for alcohol and cigarettes for young people, and the strongest drop for the youngest 8th and 10th graders. And I think that's largely a result of efforts on the parts of states and communities and federal government to reduce access to these substances. I don't think anyone really had in mind that they might prevent illicit drug use by doing that. But the fact is, I think maybe that has been an effect. The other thing I want to mention is that some of the newest drugs on the scene, like salvia, synthetic marijuana, and bath salts, have all fallen out of favor, which is good news. One of the things we know from this study is that over the years, there's always new drugs on the horizon. And young people have to make decisions without much information, except what they hear about the proponents. And I think that that it's very good news that those things are down as well. So let me stop there and ask my colleague, Richard Meek, to tell us more about the tobacco and vaping and other forms of tobacco.
Thank you, Lloyd. Good morning, all. So I want to build on Lloyd's comment that there are always new drugs on the horizons that are coming out. There are new ways of taking drugs. And one of the most prevalent new ways of using drugs has been vaping. So vaping has increased at a tremendous rate from near zero prevalence in 2011 to one of the most common forms of substance use among young people in 2015. And what we find this year, in 2016, for the first time since we've been tracking vaping, is a decline in vaping use, a significant decline among 12th graders, among 10th graders, and among 8th graders, which is all the grades that we survey. So this is indeed a novel finding, the first time it's ever happened since we've been tracking vaping. And we've also find, for the first time, that perceived risk among adolescents of vaping has gone up slightly. So if we ask adolescents, what are the possible risks of harm to you from regular vaping, we find that more adolescents are saying there is great risk from regular vaping. And it's gone up to where it's now about 20% of adolescents in each grade report great risk in vaping. So it's not a particularly high level of risk, but it has increased. The risk level itself probably isn't enough to explain why vaping prevalence has declined. It could well be that the novelty of vaping has worn off, or perhaps it's just no longer cool anymore to vape. But that will be the topic of future research. We also find this year, for the first time, hookah use. Hookah it's a rubber. A person who's using a hookah uses a mouthpiece attached to a rubber hose. A rubber hose and inhales alcohol that passes through water. They inhale tobacco smoke and that tobacco smoke is just as dangerous as cigarette smoke. And we find that hookah use has declined in 2016. That also is the first time we've ever seen hookah use decline. And this is in keeping with what we've seen, a long-standing prevalence decline in cigarette smoking. So as mentioned previously, smoking levels among 8th, 10th, and 12th graders at the lowest levels we've ever seen, which is indeed good news.
Terrific. Thank you all for our the comments. We're going to be opening the lines in one moment. Before I do so, I would like to remind everyone that supporting documentation for this teleconference can be found on the NIDA website at drugabuse.gov. The website would also have contact information for press offices for each of today's speakers if you wish to set up individual interviews. So now we'd like to open up the lines to field any questions that may exist beyond the information that's already been shared, and the operator will assist me in fielding and triaging those questions that you may have. So with that, Simon, please feel free to open up the lines for any inquiries from the press.
Sure. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star one. First question is from Mike Follick. Your line is now open.
Hi, doctors. I wanted to ask you a couple questions. The first being, you said there's a drop in use from teens of a lot of these drugs for the first time ever. How is one certain that teens are not just getting better at lying to surveyors?
I think what the question has to do, of course, what is the credibility of a survey when you're asking someone and who wants to give you a response based on what he thinks you want the response to be. And the way that we ensure that the data has credibility is we test it and compare it against the results that we get from completely independent surveys. So there are three large surveys that look at patterns of drug use among teenagers: OSS, the survey from SAMHSA, and the survey from the CDC. And across these surveys, we can compare whether there is consistency on the results reported. And what we have found is while the numbers, in terms of absolute numbers of kids that say that they take a drug, are not exactly the same, there is a high level of concordance. And also, more importantly, that the trends, that is when the drug is going up, that is identified across the three surveys consistently, and when it's going down, it's also identified that across the three surveys. They are also done using different methodology. The Monitoring the Future, which is the one that we're discussing today, is a school-based survey, whereas the other ones are home-based. And just like we are reporting in Monitoring the Future, the SAMHSA survey reported a couple of months ago also significant decreases in drug use among teenagers. So the fact that the data is reproducible makes us think that there is a robustness, and this has been seen across the inception of the survey. So we don't just rely on an indicator. And we also have surveys that are smaller that also allow us to test whether, in fact, we can corroborate the findings from this very large survey.
Okay, my other question here is about amyl nitrate, also known as poppers. I'm wondering where they actually lie in your data, and how does your survey account for the fact that poppers are not actually illegal in their other nitrite forms?
The hopers, it's inhalants, but it's a type of inhalant. So I do not know if it is actually specifically identified in the questions that relate to inhalants. So I wouldn't be able to answer that question. But you,
what is the inhalant?
Inhaler.
The amyl nitrate.
Amyl nitrate.
Amyl nitrate.
About that.
Oh,
yeah.
That actually
is. I just didn't understand the question. I don't think we ask specifically about amyl nitrates anymore.
Sorry, could you repeat that again?
I don't believe we ask specifically about amyl nitrates. We ask about a lot of things, maybe 50 classes and subclasses of drugs, but I don't believe that's one.
Amyloid nitrates.
But nitrites are being considered to be all under illicit inhalants, despite the fact that other variants of it are, you know, legal for purchase. Is that what you're saying?
No, we have a general question about inhalants, and it gives examples and so forth, but I don't think amyl nitrate is one, but even if it is, we don't ask separately about it.
Okay. Any reason for that? Even though they have very different effects from regular inhalants when we're talking about, you know, spray paint or something like that.
I can't give you a specific reason. I think it's very low.
I believe
we used to have it, and we dropped it because the prevalence was so low.
I think that the issue, you are touching on something that is always difficult. There is always emerging new drugs coming into the market. So the question is, at what point do they reach a threshold that we should be adding them into the survey? For example, now there's interest on kratom. So
the policy is now that you outlaw a specific chemical structure, but in fact, nitrites, as long as you take away the amyl part of it, it's the same drug, but that drug isn't illegal.
Yeah, I mean, I again, you are bringing up a point that is important, and with the point is we are unable to ask about all of the drug classes, but the question is how important, how frequent it is among teenagers, and we certainly can survey that using other researchers that may have the capability to start to inquire. And if the rates do come to be important, it's something that we always work with monitoring the future to add the important new questions. So if it is, we will.
Okay, and last question is, do you think that perhaps the large amount of opioid users dying has to do with the decrease in use?
Can you repeat it, the question?
The question is, do you think that the large amount of opioid users actually overdosing and dying has something to do with the decrease in usage?
No. In heroin, we are not seeing that. We are seeing actually that there is an increase in heroin use among adults. But we're also seeing a massive increase in people dying from heroin and from synthetic opioids like fentanyl. On teenagers, we're not seeing that problem.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have several other questions in the queue. Our next one, please.
Sure. Next question is from Bob Young from Seattle Time. Your line is now open.
Hello, Dr. Volkow. I would like to ask you the obvious question, and that is, why is use down, particularly or not increasing marijuana use in light of legalization and perceptions of less risk?
Yeah, very important question, and of course one that we've been posing ourselves. As I completely agree with Dr. Lloyd that one of the factors that is likely to have decreased the consumption of all drugs, and including marijuana among 8th and 10th graders, is that we've seen a significant reduction in the consumption of tobacco. And we now know from many epidemiological studies as well as preclinical studies in laboratory animals that nicotine actually serves as a gateway drug in ways that it actually affects the biology of the reward system, priming it to the rewarding effects of other drugs. In other words, if you are smoking when you take another drug, you are much more likely to like that drug and to become compulsive about its consumption. So as we decrease consumption of tobacco and nicotine specifically, we may have, unbeknownst to the prevention effort, protected kids from the rewarding effects of other drugs, and that includes marijuana. Also, the other one is alcohol, and when kids are intoxicated or any adult is intoxicated with alcohol, you're much more likely to engage on risky behaviors such as drug taking. And thus, the reduction in alcohol by itself may have also contributed to the less likelihood that the teenager will experiment or take illicit drugs like marijuana. But there is also the question that's emerging, and it's the notion that not only have drugs gone down among teenagers, but their behavior on how they interact with one another has been dramatically changed by social media. And yet we know that peer interactions are fundamental in drug taking among teenagers, and that many teenagers experiment with drugs or take them because of peer pressure. So the question that emerges is, as more teenagers are interacting through social media, could actually minimize the likelihood that there have been situations where the peer pressure makes them take drugs. That's a question, that's a speculation that needs to be investigated. Similarly, another speculation is that there's been incredible advances on technology for video gaming, and that has resulted in video games that can generate extraordinary compulsive behaviors. And this, in turn, may serve as a substitute for the effects of drugs. So, again, speculative, we need to do research on this whole area. And thus, on the one hand, prevention of and diminution of legal drugs may have prevented consumption of marijuana. And so alternative, very dramatic changes on how teenagers behave and socialize with one another may have also need to be investigated, to see if it's a contributing factor to that decline.
Dr. Volkow, can I ask a follow-up? And that is, although it's speculation, would the substitute of video gaming be considered a good thing given the violent and other disturbing facets of some video gaming?
Yeah, and it is a question that we can face with any of the technologies, right? You can have a technology that may have certain positive aspects. And when we're speaking about substitutions that come with social media and new tools, it's also cell phone technologies and not just the very fancy video games that may be substituting. Some of them are very useful, but they have, particularly among those that are vulnerable and among the most vulnerable, are adolescents and young adults, to the compulsive behavior that can emerge from some of these video games that can actually have pathological consequences such as decreases in social interactions, impaired performance at school, impaired performance at work, sleep deprivation. All of those factors, of course, are very negative.
Dr. Johnson, you have a comment?
Yeah, I wanted to comment on the issue of declining perceived risk for marijuana, not seeming to drive down or drive up the use among high school seniors. We're the ones who originally established the perceived risk was an important determinant, but we've never asserted that it's the only determinant. And usually it drives disapproval, but disapproval hasn't changed a lot for seniors. And in addition, I think there may be a difference between birth cohorts as a result of the declining use of cigarettes and alcohol. And the seniors had higher uses of cigarettes and alcohol than do 10th graders or 8th graders. So we've seen less of a downward effect there. And we know among the college students that actually marijuana is still rising. So it could be a difference by age group that eventually will disappear.
I'm sorry, was that Dr. Johnson?
That was Dr. Johnson speaking, correct. Okay, I think there may be at least one, if not several. There are at least two, three questions in the queue. Let's continue on. Saima, please put forth the next question.
Sure, and I'd like to remind all participants, please press star 1 if you have a question. Next question is from Heidi Spleet from Pediatric News. Your line is now open.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my question. I just wanted to follow up a little bit on the role of clinicians, pediatricians, family physicians, and what they can continue to do to help support this decline. What would be their role? What is the take-home message for them?
Well, even though monitoring the future does not specifically address the role of what are the different levels at which prevention can be implemented to minimize the likelihood that teenagers get exposed to drugs, we know, for example, that parents play a very important role in the community, but we also have come to recognize that the healthcare system can be a very important line of defense for early detection of substance use among teenagers. And they also can be a very good line of defense from early interventions. And this has been particularly shown to be most effective for the consumption of alcohol and to a less extent, and there is research going on, to maximize the likelihood that an intervention from a primary care physician or pediatrician can have a positive effect towards the likelihood that a teenager that has started taking drugs will change that behavior. the healthcare system is also very important because we know that teenagers that have a mental illness are at higher risk of taking drugs, and they take higher risk because they may be taking them for automedication. And that is where the healthcare system, by doing a proper evaluation of that there may be, that to rule out whether, in fact, there is an emerging mental disorder that may be driving the substance use, can do an intervention to prevent further escalation.
This is Michael Botticelli. I would add to Dr. Volkov's point, you know, healthcare practitioners have and need to play a key role in driving down the overprescribing of prescription pain medication that we see as a key driver for this opioid epidemic. And, you know, the CDC in March came out with their guideline around prescribing behavior for chronic pain. So we know that the opioid epidemic, has its root in the overprescribing of prescription pain medication and diversion to youth from unused medicine, from unused medication, as Dr. Johnson talked about. So a prime part of our strategy is ensuring that every physician and healthcare provider has a minimum amount of education on safe and effective opioid prescribing. We want to make sure that we're educating parents and others about removing unused medication from their home, because we know that 70% of prescription drug misuse starts by people getting them free from friends and family. So I think they have a particular role to play as it relates to the opioid epidemic. And again, I think this is why we were very pleased to see the continued downward trend in prescription pain misuse, particularly among a very young and vulnerable group of people.
Thank you. Great, thank you. Another question, please.
Martha Irvine, your line is now open.
Hi, this is Martha Irvine from the Associated Press. I just wondered if you could elaborate, was it that you just said that those with mental health issues are at greater risk of abusing drugs, and can you talk more about drug use and teenagers with mental health issues and or who may say they use because of stress?
Yes, and that is, that's actually the way it presents why a teenager may start taking a drug if they have an underlying mental illness. It's going to be dependent on the type of drug and on the type of problem. So, for example, among teenagers that have an attention deficit hyperactivity disorders that have not been diagnosed, the consumption of nicotine has been associated with an increased capacity to sustain attention, and therefore the importance of properly diagnosing them in order to do an intervention. Similarly, in patients suffering from an early emergence of psychotic symptoms, some of these drugs may allow them, certainly nicotine, to have an improvement in cognitive performance or even an improvement in mood, which could help explain why teenagers that may have depression are much more likely to take drugs, because at least temporarily the drugs will make them feel better, even though, of course, with a repeated use, it just exacerbates that symptoms. So this becomes particularly salient, as many times it's not easy to do a diagnosis in its early stages. And in this case, when you have a teenager that is consuming very young age drugs, that should alert the physician about the possibility that there is a reason why that teenager is using this drug. They are more vulnerable. And the good news is certain that when you treat these teenagers, you actually can prevent them from further consumption of these drugs, and their outcomes are much better.
Thank you, Dr. Volkov. I believe there is another question. Please put that through.
For one moment. Next question is from Peter from Epoch Times. Your line is now open.
Hi, this is Peter from Epoch Times. You mentioned that marijuana use was higher in states with medical marijuana laws. Was there any difference between states with medical marijuana laws and within states that have recreational marijuana laws.
And Dr. Johnston will answer that question because I don't think we have sufficient sample sizes. But
we don't have sufficient sample sizes in a few states that, that legalized recreational marijuana. So there have been other studies in those states. Colorado studies suggested that there was an increase in marijuana use among secondary school students, but I'm not able to speak to that from our own data.
Right.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, let's see. If there are any more questions, operator, please put them through.
Sure. If you have any other questions, please press star one. I'm showing no further questions at this time.
In that case, we would like to thank you all for taking the time. I'd like to a special thanks to all of our presenters, and a particular special recognition of Dr. Johnston for his 42 years of passionate work on this very important survey. So thank you, Dr. Johnston, for that. To remind the listeners that materials on this event are all found on the NIDA website, drugabuse.gov. And with that, we're going to officially conclude this teleconference. Thank you for your time, and operator, we can officially conclude.
Thank you. This now concludes today's conference, and all lines may disconnect at this time.